It required the combined strength of Nicholas, Hansit, and 8 other men to lift the lid off the stone sarcophagus. Staggering under its weight, they laid it carefully against the wall of the tomb. Then Royan and Nicholas stood on the plinth of the sarcophagus to look down into the interior. Fitted neatly into the stone receptacle was an enormous wooden coffin. Its lid, too, was in the form of the reclining pharaoh. He was in the posture of death, with his hands crossed at his breast, clutching the flail and the crook. The coffin was gilded and encrusted with semi-precious stones. The expression on the face of the king's effigy was serene. They lifted the coffin out of the sarcophagus, and its weight was less than that of the stone lid. Carefully, Nicholas split the golden seals and the layer of hard, dried resin that held the lid of the coffin in place. Within it they found another coffin, fitted perfectly. And when they opened that, yet another coffin was revealed. It was like a nest of Russian dolls, one within the other, becoming smaller with each revelation. In the end, there were 7 coffins, each of them progressively more ornate and richly decorated than the previous one. The 7th coffin was only slightly larger than a man, and it was made of gold. The polished metal caught the light of the lamps like 1,000 mirrors and threw bright arrows and darts into every recess of the tomb. When at last they opened the golden inner coffin, they found that it was filled with flowers. The blooms had dried and faded, so their colour was sepia. Their scent had long ago evaporated, so that only the musky aroma of great age wafted up from the coffin. The petals were so dry and papery that they crumbled at the first touch. Beneath the faded blooms was a layer of the finest linen. Once it must have been snowy white, but now it was brown with age and the stain of the juices from the flowers. Through the soft folds they saw once again the gleam of gold. Standing on either side of the coffin, Nicholas and Royan peeled back the linen mesh. It crackled softly and tore like tissue paper under their fingers, but as it came away they both involuntarily gasped with wonder as the death mask of Pharaoh was revealed. It was only fractionally larger than the head of a man, but it was a perfect image in every detail. Pharaoh's features had been preserved for all eternity in this extraordinary work of art. They stared in silent wonder into the obsidian and rock-crystal eyes of Pharaoh, and Pharaoh gazed back at them sadly, almost accusingly. It was a long time before either of them could summon the courage and presumption to lift it away from the head of the mummy. But when they did so, they found further evidence that in antiquity the body of the king and that of his general, Tanus, had been changed. The mummy that lay before them was obviously too large for the coffin that contained it. It had been partially unwrapped and cramped into the interior. "A royal mummy would have had hundreds of charms and amulets placed beneath the wrappings," Royan whispered. "This is the plainly dressed corpse of a nobleman, and not that of the king." Nicholas gently lifted the inner layer of bandage away from the dead head, and a thick coil of braided hair was revealed. The portraits of Pharaoh Mamose on the walls of the arcade show that his head hair was dyed with henna, Nicholas murmured. "Look at this." The braid was the colour of the winter grasses of the African savannah, gold and silver. "There can be no doubt now. This is the body of Tanus, the friend of Taita, and the lover of the queen." "Yes," Royan agreed, her eyes soft with tears. "He is the true father of Lostris's son, who became in his time the pharaoh Tammuz, and the forefather of a great line of kings. So this is the man whose blood runs through the history of ancient Egypt. In his way, he was as great as any pharaoh," Nicholas said quietly. It was Royan who roused herself first. "The river," she cried, with a razor edge to her voice. "We cannot let all of this go again when the river rises." "Neither can we hope to save all of it. There is too much, a great mass of treasure. Our time here has almost run out, so we must pick out the most beautiful and important pieces and pack them into crates. Lord alone knows if we even have time for that." So they worked in a frenzy in the short time that was left to them. They could not even think about saving the statues and the murals, the furniture and the weapons, the banqueting utensils and the wardrobes of costumes. The great golden chariot must stand where it had stood for 4,000 years. They removed the golden death mask from over Tunnels's head, but they left his mummy in the innermost of the golden coffins. Then Nicholas sent for Maimatima. The old abbot came with 20 of his monks to receive the holy relic of the ancient saint that he had been promised as his reward. Reverentially, chanting deep and slow, they bore Tunnus's coffin away to its new resting place in the Makdas of the monastery. "At least the old hero will be treated with respect," Royan said softly. Then she looked around the tomb. "We cannot leave the site like this, with the coffins thrown about and the lids discarded," Royan protested. "It looks as though grave robbers have been at work here."
"Grave robbers is exactly what we are," Nicholas smiled at her.
"No, we are archaeologists," she denied hotly, "and we must try to act like it." So they replaced the 6 remaining coffins, one within the other, laid them back in the great sarcophagus, and finally replaced the massive stone lid. Only then did Royan allow them to begin selecting and packing the treasure they would take with them. The death mask was without any doubt the premier item in the entire tomb. It fitted neatly into one of the crates, with the wooden ushabti of Taita laid alongside it, packed with styrofoam until it was firmly secured. Royan scribbled on the lid in waterproof wax crayon, "Mask and Taita ushabti." Their final selection was perforce hurried and superficial. They could not rip open every one of the cedarwood chests that were piled high in the alcoves of the arcade. The painted and gilded chests themselves were priceless artifacts and should be treated with respect. So they allowed themselves to be guided by the illustrations on the lid of each. They discovered immediately that these were indeed an accurate inventory and catalogue of the contents. In the chest which showed Pharaoh decked in the blue war crown, they found the actual crown laid on gilded leather pillows that had been moulded to fit it exactly and to protect it. Even in the short time left to them, they became almost surfeited by the magnificence of the items they uncovered as they selected and opened the cedarwood chests. Not only the blue crown, but the red and white crown of the kingdoms united was there, and the splendid Nemi's crown, all three in such a miraculous state of preservation that they might have been lifted from Pharaoh's brow that morning. From the very outset, it had to be a prerequisite that any artifact must be small enough to fit into one of the ammunition crates. If it were too large, no matter what its value or historical significance, then it had to be rejected and left in the tomb. Fortunately, many of the cedarwood chests containing the royal jewellery fitted snugly into the metal crates, so that not only the contents but all the chests themselves could be saved. However, the larger items, the crowns and the huge jewelled gold pectoral medallions, had to be repacked. As the ammunition crates were filled, they carried them down and stacked them on the landing outside the sealed doorway, ready to be carried out, including the crates that contained the 8 statuettes of the gods from the Long Gallery. They had packed and catalogued 48 crates when they heard Sapper's unmistakable accents floating up the staircase. "Major, where the hell are you? You can't bugger about in here any longer. Come on, man. Get your hairy ass out of here. The river is in full spate, and the dam's going to burst at any minute." Sapper came bounding up the staircase, but even he stopped in wonder and awe as he looked for the first time upon the splendours of the funeral arcade of Pharaoh Mamose. It took some minutes for him to recover from the shock and to revert to his old prosaic self again. "I mean it, Major. It's a matter of minutes, not hours. That ruddy dam's going to go. Apart from that, Mech is fighting in the hills at the head of the chasm. You can hear the gunfire even at the bottom of the cliff in Taita's pool. You and Royan have to get out fast, I kid you not." "Okay, Sapper, we're on our way. Get back to the chamber at the bottom of those stairs. You saw those ammunition crates down there?" Sapper nodded, and Nicholas went on quickly. "Have the men lug those crates out of here. Get them down to the monastery. I want you to supervise that part of it. We will follow you down the trail with the rest of them. Well, don't mess around, Major. Your life ain't worth a pile of old junk like this. Get moving now." "Get on with it, Sapper. But don't let Royan hear you call it a pile of old junk. You could be in really serious trouble." Sapper shrugged. "Don't say I didn't warn you." He turned and started back down the staircase. You know where the boats are stashed? Nicholas shouted after him. If you get there before me, get them inflated and the crates lashed down. We'll be right behind you.
The moment Sapper was gone, Nicholas raced back down the arcade to where Royan was still at work in the treasury.
That's it, he shouted at her. No more. Let's get out.
Nicky, we can't leave this out.
He grabbed her arm. We are getting out now, unless you want to share Tunnel's tomb with him on a permanent basis.
Can't I just...
No, you crazy woman. Now. The dam will go at any moment. She broke away from him, snatched up some handfuls of leftover jewellery from the open chest at her feet, and began stuffing them into her pockets.
I can't leave these.
He seized her round the waist and swung her over his shoulder.
I told you I meant it, he said grimly, and ran with her down the arcade. Nicky, put me down!
She kicked with outrage, but he continued running down into the chamber at the foot of the staircase. Hansit and his men were carrying the last few packed ammunition crates up the staircase on the far side of the chamber. They balanced the crates easily on their heads and went up the steps with alacrity. Here Nicholas set Royan down on her own feet again.
You promise to behave now? We aren't playing games. This is deadly serious. I mean deadly if we get trapped down here.
I know. She looked contrite. I just couldn't bear to leave the rest of it.
Enough of that. Let's go.
Nicholas grabbed her hand and dragged her after him. After the first few steps, she shook her hand free and started to run in earnest, outstripping him and reaching the top of the staircase a few paces ahead of him.
Even under their burdens, the porters were making good time. Caught up in the long, hurrying column, Nicholas and Royan wound their way back through the maze, grateful for the signposts at each corner, and made it down the central staircase into the ruined long gallery without taking a wrong turning.
Sapper was waiting for them at the ruins of the sealed doorway, and grunted with relief when he saw them amongst the porters.
"I thought I told you to go on ahead and get the boats ready," Nicholas shouted at him. "Couldn't trust you not to be bloody stupid,"
Sapper looked miserable. "Wanted to make sure you didn't hang about in there."
"I'm touched, Sapper," Nicholas punched his shoulder, and then they ran down the approach tunnel and clattered over the bridge across the sinkhole.
"Where's Mech?" Nicholas panted at Sapper's back as he jogged in front of him. "Have you seen Tessé?"
"Tessé's back. She had a nasty experience. She was in a terrible mess. Seems she got badly knocked about."
"What's happened to her?" Nicholas was appalled. "Where is she?"
"Looks like she fell into the hands of von Schiller's guerrillas, and they beat the hell out of her. Mech's men are taking her down to the monastery. She will wait for us at the boats."
"Thank God for that," Nicholas muttered, and then louder. "What about Mech?"
"He's trying to hold off Nogo's attack. I've been hearing rifle fire and grenades and mortar shells all morning. He too is going to fall back and wait for us at the boats."
They ran the last few yards down the tunnel, ankle deep in slush and water, and at last crawled over the wall of the cofferdam onto the rocky ledge around Taita's pool. Nicholas looked up to see Hansit's porters scrambling up the bamboo scaffolding ladder towards the top of the cliff, each of them hauling up one of the ammunition crates.
At that moment he caught the sound that he recognised instantly. He cocked his head to listen, and then told Royan grimly, "Gunfire. Mech is fighting it out, but it's pretty darn close."
"My bag!" Royan started towards her thatched shelter at the foot of the cliff. "I must get my kit."
"You won't need your makeup or your pyjamas, and I've got your passport."
He seized her arm and turned her back towards the foot of the ladder. "In fact, the only thing you need now is plenty of space between you and Colonel Nogo. Come along, Royan."